At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Future-proof extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, last month, ITER, or ITER, depending on where you come from, the world's flagship project to prove the viability of fusion energy, announced a 4-year delay to its major experiments, pushing them back to 2039 at a cost of more than $5 billion. And considering the urgency of climate crisis and energy advancements happening elsewhere, is the whole idea of fusion dead, or will ITER one day come good? Well, joining us now to discuss is Dr. Brian D. Appleby. He's a research fellow in the physics department at Imperial College London. Great to have you on the program, Brian. I have actually gone to France. I was in the south of France, and I was in the ITER facility for a TV program I was doing. And that was a long time ago. And there was a lot of talk about how this will have a dramatic effect on, you know, advancing our goal towards free and clean, limitless energy. But it's crazy now for me to think that in 2039, that's where they're going to be starting its major experiments. Just for those who aren't familiar, maybe set up the idea of this experiment and what it's aiming to do, what it's not aiming to do, and then we can talk about the rest.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Jonathan. Well, at a very basic level, what it's trying to do is to create energy by the same process by which the sun creates energy, and that is by fusing atoms together, which then releases energy. And this is in contrast, existing nuclear power plants are based on fission, where you're splitting atoms to generate energy, whereas here, much like happens in the sun, we want to fuse them together to produce the energy. The challenge with doing that is you must essentially heat those atoms to an extremely high temperature. They must be at the same temperature as the center of the sun. And when you do that, the material that you get is called a plasma, and it tends to want to fly apart, to explode. So essentially, we must find these very complex ways in which we can get these atoms, heat them up to be the same temperature as the sun, and then keep them confined such that they're actually producing the energy in a controlled manner. And so ITER aims to do this by essentially using very large magnets to confine the material while it's burning. This device essentially doing that process, because it's at such extremely high temperatures, it requires quite a lot of technological complexity.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, some of the physics that goes into building something like this, where in terms of temperature, as you get close to the plasma, which is sort of being held in place by magnetic fields, you're reaching temperatures close to the sun, but only a couple of feet away and it's room temperature, which is an insane amount of engineering required, right?
Exactly, yeah. And this is kind of one of the reasons that ITER has run into these difficulties, because it's just such an extreme environment. And, you know, we can create these what we call plasmas that are at similar temperatures to the center of the sun, but then they're just emitting so much radiation and things like neutrons that they will damage any of the materials that are, you know, next to them to do that confinement. So it's really these engineering extremes that we're trying to, you know, the challenges that come from these. And that's where a lot of the difficulties have come from.
In terms of the science, when we loosen the forces that hold atoms together, it releases a huge amount of energy. And when we force two atoms to fuse together, that also releases a lot of energy. Is that the principle behind it? What sort of fuel do we use for these reactors?
Yes, yeah, so that's the principle. And it depends what part of the periodic table you're in. And, you know, that determines how much energy you're released. Hmm. So essentially, when you look at the very start of the periodic table, where you've elements like hydrogen and helium, these are the atoms that when we fuse them together will give us net energy out. Whereas you need to go to the end of the periodic table for uranium to do the fission to release energy from separating them. Hmm. So in our case, you know, the most desirable atoms to use are essentially variations on hydrogen. So these are isotopes of hydrogen called deuterium and tritium. Deuterium is something that we can extract quite easily from seawater. Whereas tritium, it's an isotope of hydrogen where it's got two neutrons and a proton all bundled together. But that's much rarer. And essentially, we need to manufacture tritium in order to feed our, you know, nuclear fusion experiments.
Is that one of the reasons why this technology is delayed? Why are we seeing, you know, a 4-year delay is one thing, but this machine was conceived in the 80s, funded in the 90s. They started building in the noughties. Why is it taking so long?
So I think there are many reasons to it. The first one is this: the sheer complexity of it. And so it was conceived, as you say, you know, over 30 years ago, and it was never going to be built overnight. You know, the timescales involved were always very long term. The costs were always going to be extremely huge. So I think the concern is not that it's taking decades to build it, but more so that delays are causing it to be pushed back.
Right.
And, you know, some of those things, you know, these delays are somewhat expected. You know, as you design and build this, you realize, well, actually, the, you know, the cost of materials has increased. You know, you just have no control over that, for example. And also, you know, things like, we've realized, well, some of the parts that have been manufactured, they weren't quite to the levels that were required. So now there must be some engineering to improve that. But then there are also some challenges that perhaps were less expected. And so one of these is related to the tritium we were talking about. And so the French nuclear safety regulator, because this has been built in France, so they're over, you know, one of the bodies overseeing it. And they have put in certain recommendations about how this facility is going to handle that tritium material, because it is somewhat radioactive. And so therefore, they've put in extra requirements for handling of this tritium material, which is another source of the delays.
Right.
So there isn't one sort of standout factor for these delays, but more sort of an accumulation of things, which somewhat reflects just the complexity of what it is that they're trying to do.
Is an international scientific consortium nimble enough to adapt to the inevitable changes in technology? Like, billions have gone on this project. It's taken so long that surely our understanding of physics and our ability to use newer techniques has developed beyond what this was originally intended for.
I think that's a really interesting question, and I'm going to slightly sidestep it by saying, well, I'm just a scientist. I'm not an economist or an engineer. But I think it is really interesting. And you mentioned at the start about how ITER is like the flagship fusion experiment that, you know, we're working on internationally. But it is just one of many different approaches that are currently under investigation. So, you know, there's been a lot, you know, one of the things that's happened over the last 10 years is there's been a lot of private companies, startup companies who think they can do fusion faster and cheaper than ITER using different types of experiments and different approaches. You know, some of them I think are quite credible. Some of them might be, you know, overly optimistic with what they're trying to do. Mm. But certainly they've kind of, I suppose, in a way, set the cat amongst the pigeons, because there is this sense of maybe there is an easier way of doing it than ITER. Now, none of those companies really have come up with a, you know, a really successful experiment yet. So I think, you know, the jury is still out on that.
Would it be fair to say, if I rephrase that question, if you were going to build ITER today, would you have built it differently?
I think there is a sense that the design is not what I think there's a consensus among scientists that
I can see your face trying to very carefully word this, because I get a sense that you want to say yes, but you have political reasons why you can't.
I'm certainly hesitant to speak for all scientists, but certainly there are a lot of strong claims by you know, a lot of different scientific groups that if we were starting again, you know, and planning all this large scale investment, we would be looking at a slightly different design. So, you know, I think that's true, but that's, you know, some of that might be natural in the sense of much of this design is 20 years old. So we would just expect that there would be an evolution in our thinking.
Yeah.
And we cannot really compete with the fact that building such a thing does require decades of investment. Mm. So I think it might just be a natural part of the process.
And it's important for the audience to understand that while we in Europe have invested a huge amount in ITER and other stakeholders as well, that the idea behind ITER was never to create a fusion reactor. It was never to actually provide anywhere with a viable and continuous source of free and clean energy, right? This is just one step along quite a long path to developing the technology that would give us more energy out than we put in.
Exactly, yeah. And I think, you know, I'm a scientist. Most of us working in fusion still very much consider ourselves scientists doing scientific experiments, whereby we're just learning how this plasma material behaves and how it is that we can control it and most efficiently get the energy out. There's a huge amount of engineering and economic challenges in order to, you know, to actually have a viable energy source. So I think for the moment, you know, what we're really focused on is, well, can we meet all of the scientific challenges that are required, you know, to have the components for a fusion power plant? It's an entirely separate, you know, debate then about whether we can do that in a way that's kind of economically efficient.
Mm. Yeah. And at the same time, this is very much what the EU and stakeholders have kind of pointed towards, that this is our path to you know, green and sustainable and clean energy. When realistically, if we look at the timelines of some of the, you know, the global limits that we're talking about when it comes to climate change, we're never going to get there before that becomes too late, right? Fusion is not going to be our solution to climate change. It's fair to say, with the sort of talk that's been around about climate change, that's we've passed that, right? It's 50 years away still for actual fusion energy, even if we crack the technology, and that's too late for the planet.
I think, you know, there's not many, you know, I don't think anyone has really ever made a serious claim that this is what we need to combat climate change. I think all those working in the field have kind of recognized that it is a longer term thing. And, you know, we need other solutions, you know, green energy solutions to combat climate change right now. I think, you know, what fusion has going for it is that it is a very different way of producing energy that is an extremely, like, powerful energy source. And effectively, per unit mass of fuel, it is the most efficient energy source that we could expect to generate on Earth. So, you know, it is a unique energy source if we can develop it that would be particularly useful. You know, but I think we cannot guarantee that the timescales will be what we need for combating climate change.
Mm. Because I have, you know, at times kind of said, you know, obviously, I am a big advocate of fission. I think the technologies have advanced in fission to a level where they're much safer than previous years. And I think we should have been working on those across the world because we know it works. We know how to make it safe. And the dangers need to be put aside because the dangers of climate change are much, much bigger. But I certainly was advocating that we invest everything we can in fusion to try and make it happen quicker. That's just not really... it's not really a credible or feasible approach, is it, for everybody just to focus on fusion to get it here quicker?
I think the challenge really with it is we're just, so we know fission works in the sense we know it effectively, we can build effective power plants with it. I would say we also know fusion works. You know, we've done experiments where we're producing more energy out than we are, you know, putting into the experiment initially. But, you know, we just have so many sort of technical engineering challenges to do that on a commercial basis that, you know, I think we just don't know the timescale for that. I would say that investment in it is very important simply because, you know, these experiments are extremely difficult to do. And, you know, as we do the experiments, we learn a lot more. So in the longer scale, we are building towards something. But I think it's not a case that right now we just need more money in order to, you know, solve the problem overnight. I'll add the caveat here that I'm sure if you talk to someone who works at one of these private fusion companies that are, you know, keen for investment, they might have a different take on it to what I do.
Yeah. And just to finish with, I suppose, a bit of hope, what is the potential of fusion? If in 30, 40, 50 years time, you know, this experiment really leads the way, new technologies implemented give us a quicker way to fusion, what is the promise of fusion for energy?
So I think that the easiest way of kind of highlighting the advantages of it are to compare it with, you know, fission power plants. And essentially, you know, a lot of the advantages of fission power plants in that it's an extremely reliable way of producing a very large amount of energy. But in contrast to fission power plants, it is essentially a much safer form of nuclear energy. So the radioactive materials that we produce in fusion experiments, there is just much, much less of them than in fission, and they're much, much easier to handle. Also, there is just no, by the nature of the way that we do fusion experiments, there is no chance that you can have any sort of runaway reaction process or any sort of criticality issues like, you know, we've seen historically with some fission power plants. So I think, you know, it has those advantages in comparison with fission. Also, the fuel that we're using, these isotopes of hydrogen, you know, tend to be, we think we should have them much more readily available, and therefore the costs of the fuel should be much lower. So I think.
And the raw material is water, which is crazy.
So one part of the raw material is water, and then the tritium that we talked about earlier, effectively you would breed the tritium within the fusion reactor itself. And just, I guess, to tie this all together, going back to ITER, one of the things, you know, ITER is not being built as a power plant to produce energy, but it is going to be doing some, you know, basic experiments related to how we build a power plant, including looking at how we'd manufacture the tritium within the reactor itself.
So still reason to continue with the experiment, still a lot of hope for fusion in the distant future. But for now, it's not going to save all of our problems. It remains, however, a fascinating quest in science. Dr. Brian Appleby, Research Fellow in the Physics Department at Imperial College London. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.